This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Friday will mark the one-year anniversary of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. In the wake of the Gulf War, the Bush administration has been desperately trying to bring Israel and the Arab countries to the negotiating table in the hopes of creating a lasting peace. At the same time, the UN is still trying to uncover all of Iraq's chemical and nuclear weapons programs. Inspectors say the Iraqis have been underreporting the number of arsenals it has, as well as destroying evidence by razing buildings and exploding or burying equipment. So not only is Saddam Hussein still in power after losing the war, he's still defying the victors and the UN. We invited Tom Friedman back to Fresh Air to talk with us about the Middle East 1 year after the invasion. Friedman is a New York Times diplomatic correspondent who covers the Middle East. He's been focusing lately on the peace talks. Friedman is also the author of From Beirut to Jerusalem. The paperback edition is about to begin its 52nd week on the bestseller list. Iraq's defiance of UN inspectors has led to speculation that the U.S. might launch another military strike. I asked Friedman what he thinks the odds are that will happen.
At this stage, Terry, I'd put them at 50-50 for a couple of reasons. One is that Saddam Hussein, if he's learned one lesson from the Gulf War, it's don't make yourself an easy target. And by sort of complying with the United Nations, you know, sending a letter, having the inspectors in, oh, shucks, I forgot something, here's another letter, send the inspectors back, he's maneuvering himself in a way that makes him not a totally easy target. It's not like a clean-cut situation of defiance. That's one reason. The other reason is that you have a lot of our allies from the Gulf War who are very uneasy about us going after him again. Take, for instance, the Syrians. Syrian President Hafez al-Assad to this day still hasn't really told his people that he sent troops to the Gulf War because he's that uneasy about it, uneasy in the sense that Syrian public opinion remains very sympathetic to Saddam Hussein. So the idea now that we would go in and undertake yet another strike against him, I think would make the Syrians uneasy, the Turks uneasy, the Egyptians uneasy. And so for those two reasons, I think the president has certain constraints on him.
What about the other 50%, the 50% reason why we might have another military strike?
Well, the 50% reason you might is that the main threat that Saddam Hussein posed to American national interests was the fact that he possessed the potential to develop weapons of mass destruction that could, to begin with, threaten our immediate allies in the Middle East and might one day threaten us. And to the extent that the United States has not been able to strip him of those weapons, then its vital interests in prosecuting this war have not been fully realized.
Is there a big debate about this ongoing in the Bush administration?
Absolutely. And I think that it isn't resolved. I think the Pentagon is very uneasy about re-engaging there. I think the president is because, you know, you can sit back and say, well, we didn't get it all or whatnot, but we got a lot. Now, you go in now and maybe you don't get it all. There's a messy operation. It can really sour the whole enterprise in the way. It can certainly muddy the waters.
You've been writing a lot about the peace talks, and you've been shuttling back and forth almost as much as Baker has been. You seem to think that the peace talks are really an attempt to give the war a legacy beyond the fact that we were there for pragmatic self-interest. Do you think that they go beyond that as well?
Well, I mean, I do believe that President Bush really believed that the Gulf War victory was not enough to justify the war. Americans don't pray for peace in the Persian Gulf in church and synagogue every weekend. They pray for peace in the Holy Land. That's the romantic story. That's the messianic story, as you will. And I think that after the war was over and people surveyed the aftermath, and a lot of people said, geez, what do we do? Well, we destroyed half the Iraqi army, and we restored the al-Sabah clan to power in Kuwait, and now they're putting people in prison for life for wearing Saddam Hussein T-shirts. So what was that all about? So I think because of that, I think that there was a desire by the president to find a way to invest this war with some larger cosmic theme, and that is that it would lead to peace in the Holy Land, not just peace in the Persian Gulf. But that's a very difficult matter.
Each country seems to be willing to go to the table to win the favor of the United States or repay a favor to the United States. Do you think anyone will be going because they genuinely want to talk?
No. Not in this neighborhood. Look, what they've been able to do, Terry, is to get everyone to do the right thing for the wrong reasons. Now, if you wait around in the Middle East for people to do the right thing for the right reasons, you wait forever. So there's nothing wrong with that. But the fact is, nobody's had therapy here, and nobody's been through EST. Everyone is making very cold-blooded calculations about how they want to either preserve or recast their relations with the United States. That's what this is about, first and foremost. The question is, can a peace conference born of such motives really produce something larger? And that's very, very much an open question. But I don't think we should have any illusions as to what this is about.
Let's look at some of the individual countries and what their motives might be for attending the peace talks. Let's start with Syria.
Well, the Syrians are, I think, being driven to the peace table not as the result of any fallout from the Gulf War, but really as a result of a fallout from the Cold War. To put it simply, Syria's patron, the Soviet Union, has been defeated by the United States. And the Syrians woke up at some point in the last couple of years and really discovered that they were an orphan in the game of geopolitics. And the Soviet Union is no longer capable of rearming them, no longer capable of sustaining them, either militarily, politically, or economically, or diplomatically even. And as a result, I think President Assad calculated was that now that there's only one superpower, it was time to really try to forge a deal with Washington, particularly with this administration, which I think he feels is, relatively speaking, sympathetic to the Arab cause. And I think he's also reading another fallout from the Cold War, the fact that a million Soviet Jews may descend on Israel in the next year or two, and they're going to be settled all over the place, come what may. And if there was ever an urgency to try to recover the Golan Heights, which Syria lost to Israel during the 1967 war, than it was now. So I think that's really what's driving him first and foremost.
What about Jordan?
Well, the Jordanians, they need political and diplomatic rehabilitation. King Hussein supported Saddam Hussein during the Gulf War. He not only suffered alienation from his longtime superpower ally, the United States, but his funding was cut off by the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, and the other Arab Gulf states. So he very badly needs to be re-embraced by President Bush, and to have President Bush go to the Gulf states and order them or ask them or plead with them to turn the money tap back onto the Jordanians.
Why is Lebanon willing to go to the peace talks?
Because the Syrians ordered him to.
Okay.
The Lebanese will be going because their very powerful neighbor to the east, the Syrians, want them to be there, and the Syrians now dominate the Lebanese government. At the same time, the Lebanese certainly have an interest, given the fact that Israel still has a security zone on Lebanese territory in South Lebanon, in seeing if it can resolve its security situation in South Lebanon in a way that would be satisfactory to Israel, so that the Israelis might be inclined to go back to their borders.
And the Saudis?
The Saudis, this is just business. I think they would rather not have anything to do with this process, given their druthers. It's only a loser for King Fahd. He doesn't need an Israeli embassy in Riyadh. That will only cause him trouble with his own religious elite. But he owes George Bush one big favor. George Bush sent 500,000 troops to the Gulf to save his riches and reign. And when the president thumped the table and said, look, I need you there, in the end they had to pony up.
Now, the Israelis have really been resisting saying yes to the talks, but now it looks like they'd be willing to attend if they get their way with the Palestinian representation. They refuse to talk with Palestinians from East Jerusalem or the diaspora. So who will they talk to?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that the Palestinian that they're ready to talk to has really been born yet. But we'll just have to see. It's, you know, everyone that gets sort of thrown up as a possible interlocutor, you know, one has two left feet, the other has a brown eye and a green eye, the other one, his sister-in-law wrote a poem. So there's a million reasons why you can reject any number of Palestinians, and we could go on with this name game for a long time.
The Israelis want to talk to Palestinians who would be part of a Jordanian-Palestinian joint delegation. What's the logic behind that?
Well, the logic behind that is that two things. First of all, let me give you the real logic, the sort of macro logic, then I'll give you the micro logic. The macro logic is that, look, Israel won the Gulf War without really firing a shot. The United States, in destroying the Iraqi army, destroyed the greatest strategic threat to the state of Israel. So Israel ended the war with the balance of power in the Middle East radically in its favor. And that's the power reality. So now, having done that, they feel like George Bush is coming to them and saying, thank you very much. Now we'd like you to make concessions to those Palestinians who were supporting your enemy, Iraq, in the war, and were on the losing side. And Shamir says, now, wait a minute. That doesn't make any sense to me. And it doesn't make any sense in pure, naked power politics terms. And so what Shamir is essentially saying to the Palestinians is that you're going to have to eat everything that you stand for. And the Palestinians say, well, look, you know, we're ready to eat a teaspoonful, maybe a bowlful. And Shamir says, no, no, you don't understand. You got to eat the whole smorgasbord, okay? You got to start at the beginning, go right through the salads, the entree, and the dessert. You're going to have to eat everything. Now, what does that mean? That means you can come to the conference, but A, the PLO cannot be in any way involved in your delegation, i.e., the organization that you believe embodies your national symbols, your claim to statehood, cannot be present. You can't have a PLO flag even at the table. Secondly, you cannot have any East Jerusalemites in your delegation because we, Israel, have annexed East Jerusalem. And if we, excuse me, allow any East Jerusalemites in your delegation, it might imply that we believe that East Jerusalem is negotiable, which it isn't. So what we're ready to do is let you have representatives from the West Bank and Gaza who will come as basically Palestinians representing those under Israeli occupation, or you can have Palestinians from Jordan coming under a Jordanian flag. But one way or another, you got to eat the whole smorgasbord.
Do you think the Palestinians are likely to go along with Israel's demands for their representation?
Well, it's a problem. And this is where a high diplomacy meets the wild earth. Because the Palestinians said, look, even if we were ready to eat the whole smorgasbord, by the time I got through the salads, I'd be killed. See, it's not such a simple matter. You know, I thought the news story of the week last week, the one that will have the greatest impact on all these negotiations, was a little story out of Jenin. Jenin is a major Palestinian town in the northern West Bank. The head of the Arab hospital there had been accused by Palestinians a year ago of being a collaborator, and he fled to Jordan. He spent the year in Jordan. He came back last week with a letter from Yasser Arafat and the PLO saying, this man is not a collaborator. He is a clean man. Lay off. Leave him alone. Last Thursday, masked gunmen came into his hospital, went into his office, and blew his brains all over his desk. Now, the subliminal message that that sends to every potential Palestinian negotiator is that even the PLO can't protect you. So the idea that Palestinians are going to go to a conference under the terms dictated by Shamir, I think, is very difficult, because even it's not because they're so in love with Yasser Arafat necessarily, and not because that they wouldn't like to be there. It's a very simple matter. You get very dead if you go, and no one can protect you.
Palestinians are being kicked out of several Middle Eastern countries now. Where are they going, those who are being asked to leave the country?
Most are going back to Jordan. Some are literally floating around camps on the Kuwait-Iraqi border, but most who have Jordanian passports are flooding back to Jordan.
Would you say the war was really devastating for the Palestinians?
No question about it. They are the big losers. Even Saddam Hussein managed to survive the war, but they made a very wrong and strategically and morally wrong choice, and they're paying for it.
We're talking about the proposed peace talks in the Middle East, and my guest is New York Times reporter Tom Friedman, who's also the author of the bestseller From Beirut to Jerusalem. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Tom Friedman is my guest, and he's a reporter for the New York Times and author of the bestseller From Beirut to Jerusalem. What do you think George Bush or James Baker really wants out of Middle East peace talks?
Well, neither of these men are really moved by any deep feelings about the Middle East or any messianic or biblical notions. They'd be the first to tell you that. This is about business for them. This is a problem. It's one they want to solve. As I said, I think that they feel it would be a nice capstone to the Gulf War, but I don't think they're under any illusions that somehow they're going to be able to do it. I just think, unfortunately, I think for them, the conference is an end in itself.
So if it happens, the Bush administration looks like it did its job by bringing all the parties
exactly
together, even if nothing comes out.
We got them together, and look at these people. They're impossible. But look at us. We got them together. It ain't a Nobel Peace Prize, but, you know, it's a feather in your cap.
Is the United States calling in all of its chits for the Middle East Peace Conference? Is it going to spend all of its newly won political capital on this?
Well, it's certainly going to spend a lot of capital to get these people to the table, that's for sure. Whether it's all, I don't really know, and that will depend, I think, on the course of the conference. But, you know, history teaches us something very simple, and that's that peace conferences don't change reality. All they do is ratify or confirm a reality that has or has not been changed on the ground. And the diplomats around the table can do nothing that the soldiers on the ground have not already done one way or another. And that's why I think, you know, this peace conference could be imperiled as soon as it's born, because it does not grow out of any fundamental reshaping of the balance of power on the ground.
You've been following James Baker back and forth.
Don't remind me.
Yeah. Do you travel on the same plane with him? Is there
yes.
a press on that plane?
Yeah, there's a few of us in the back.
What's the atmosphere like on the plane?
Well, you know, it's a very small group. It's not like traveling with the White House. I mean, there's a dozen or so of us. And it's been fun to watch. You know, I've had a front row to history here. It's not like being a reporter on the ground. I mean, the great thing about being a reporter on the ground is that the drama is unfolding before your eyes. When you cover diplomacy, as it were, you know, now I wear a suit and a tie and I'm there on the plane. I've got an embossed card that says I'm a diplomatic correspondent. But it's not nearly as much fun. I mean, I feel like I've gone from covering a street to covering a hall, and from covering a drama that was unfolding before my eyes when I was a foreign correspondent on the ground to covering a policy that's invisible. I mean, what is the policy? A policy is a collection of invisible grunts and nods and winks.
How forthcoming is James Baker when you speak with him? Do you have to get most of your information behind the scenes, or do you get a lot of it directly from him?
Well, you know, he gives press conferences at every stop. He comes back and talks to us on the plane sometimes, on the record, sometimes on background, sometimes off the record. Sometimes the same sentence, the first half is on the record, the second quarter is off the record, and the third quarter is on background. He's not exactly, how should I put it? I mean, he doles out his information very carefully through the drip method, and he believes that knowledge is power, and he keeps a lot to himself.
This Friday will be the year anniversary of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. It's, I think, a time when a lot of people will be reflecting on the war and what it's meant, what it's changed. What are some of your thoughts on this year anniversary?
Well, you know, I never had any illusions about this war from the beginning, Terry. If you look back on what I've written, I was even very dubious about it at the very beginning, I mean, back in a year ago, because at that time I was focused very much on Kuwait and really kind of raising questions about exactly what kind of society are we jumping in here to save. But I think as the year went on, I, like many Americans, I think came to recognize that Saddam Hussein truly was an evil dictator, a man with weapons of mass destruction, a man who really did rape a country. And when you see what he's done to Kuwait, and I've had the fortune or misfortune to go there to see the burning oil wells, the incredible ecological disaster, the way the National Museum there has been stripped bare, the way the Iraqi soldiers literally looted one home after another, you realize that it was a dirty job, but someone had to do it, that that he had to be stopped, and it was the right thing. And I don't think that we should have any regrets about it. But I also don't build it up into anything more than it was. There was a bad man. He had to be stopped. We stopped him. But I don't think that we have to invest it with a lot of the cosmic qualities that everyone now demands of it.
In spite of your skepticism about the peace talks, would you be anxious to cover them if they do happen?
As long as it doesn't fall on my vacation.
Pragmatic way of looking at it.
I have a feeling it'll be there when I get back.
Right. Well, have a good vacation.
Thanks.
Tom Friedman, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Tom Friedman is a correspondent for the New York Times. He's been covering the Middle East and the peace talks.
For too many years.
He's also the author of the best-selling book From Beirut to Jerusalem, and a new edition of this book will be published in September. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.